On this episode of Baseball Barbacast, the regular season has finally arrived, and we preview it by talking about Jake's list of the top 50 most influential people in 2026 in the world of baseball. We give you our opening day starter draft, and then we go around the league talking PCA extension, Kevin McGonigal making the team, Connor Griffin not making the team, and baseball on Netflix. All that and more on this episode of Baseball Barbacast.
Hello and welcome to Baseball Barbacast, the only baseball podcast in the world that believes opening day eve is better than opening day. I'm Jake Mitz. That's Jordan Schusterman. And this year, opening day is like a Jewish holiday. It starts at night.
That is a good take. But as you mentioned, this is not one where we are waiting patiently. Normally, this Wednesday is the day of rest, the day of patience. The day of pause and preparation for the marathon ahead. Instead, we need not wait until Thursday afternoon for this here baseball season to begin, as the Giants and Yankees will face off on Netflix on Wednesday night to begin the 2026 season. This is our final off-season podcast. Funny way to put it, but I think that that is a good way to put it. And a great way to set the tone, because we've made it. We've made it through the winter months. Spring has sort of kind of sprung, depending on where you are. And baseball, Major League Baseball, regular season Major League Baseball is back. Jake, we have a lot to get to on this Wednesday edition of Baseball Barbacast. And we are going to begin with something you've been working on all week, and that is our opener.
What is the Major League Baseball regular season, if not a series of cascading, unfurling stories? Characters presented to us on platters, narratives rising and falling, cresting like the waves. Because our season is so long, it is a marathon, not a sprint, we get real character development over the course of the year. And for the last smattering of seasons, I have attempted to preview the season through this lens, thinking about the most influential people in the sport, the characters that will define the season to be. The first half of my list is already up at Yahoo Sports from 50 to 26. The top half will be up at some point later today. I put a lot of time into this. It is a silly exercise. It is not statistically based. It is totally subjective, and that is why I enjoy doing it.
Yes, and this is not just 50 Major League Baseball players. I think that is an important place to start, and we can start digging into some of the individuals. We're certainly not going to get to all 50 in this conversation. We have plenty more fun stuff, much more fun stuff to come later on in this episode. We're going to do our opening day starter draft. That's going to be our second segment. But as you mentioned, this is a good opportunity to set the stage for what are we going to spend this season talking about? Who are the players that are going to have us get on these microphones and have long conversations contemplating their seasons, their careers, their ups, their downs, their triumphs, their failures? And I think that this group of 50 individuals is a compelling collection of people that will be doing that. Now, some of that is because of the teams that they are on, which we expect to be good. Some of that is because these are just great players. And some of that is because these are things that are different about the 2026 Major League Baseball season. And so I think that that is an important thing to think about when you're wondering, oh, well, why is that really good player missing? Well, there's only room for so many. And I also think that this is an exercise where you want to have some fun writing it. I think that also dictates some of the structure, some of the groupings of some of these players. I also think an important place to maybe begin and to recognize before we start talking about some of these individuals is the order, I feel like, matters a little bit more at the very, very top. And then from there, you're kind of floating between different storylines. But in terms of making the list, do you have any other big picture things before we get into it?
If you're angry at me that I put Nick Kurtz at 33 and not at 32, well, you can come figure out where I live. and track me down. I have nothing to say to you about that. Jordan, can we actually begin at 50? Can we just start at 50?
Oh.
Because this is someone who is in the news right now, and I think is definitely worth a conversation. And that is Roki Sasaki.
Yeah. So it's been a tough go for Roki. Roki was, I imagine, much higher on this list a year ago, going into his rookie season.
And he was at 9.
At 9, okay. And I think in some respects you could argue, you know, it's funny. I remember discussing it last year and wondering if that was too high even a year ago. And I think the argument at the time was Roki's very interesting because of this unique free agent situation that just unfolded and the fact that he picked the Dodgers. But how important is he going to be to the Dodgers winning and losing? And in some respects, that take proved to be valid in that he was terrible for essentially the whole regular season or injured. We know he got some big outs in October. This year, I think you could kind of ask the same question. Because despite the Dodgers' insistence that he will be in the rotation, he has not performed in a way that looks like he is going to be an important part of them winning baseball games, at least right away. And so that would be the argument against him being on this list. But the whole developmental story is compelling enough that I think he definitely still has a case.
He was not on the original version of the list, but he was so undeniably ass in spring training, so unequivocally unpitchable, that he crowbarred his way into my mind. Sasaki finished spring training with an ERA that has four letters. With an ERA that has four numbers in it. His final outing of spring, he did not get an out in the first inning. He was removed and then put back into the game. He is not throwing strikes. He did not allow a hit in his final outing, but boy, did he not know where the strike zone was. He's going to be in the rotation. Dave Roberts was asked, hey, Dave, is Roki one of your best 13 pitchers? And Dave responded by saying, quote, he's going to begin the season in the rotation. Which is incredible. That's like, you're like, I love you. Do you love me? And you saying, you love me, or I like empanadas, or let's go on a date. The not answer is the answer. No matter what happens with Roki this season, it will be fascinating. If he's in the big leagues and he's bad, that's interesting. If he doesn't throw a pitch, that's interesting. If he's amazing, that's interesting. I cannot wait to see how this unfolds.
I plead the fifth is basically where Dave Roberts went with that answer. It's just so weird because he makes 8 starts in the regular season and is very bad, right? 10 starts, sorry. 10 outings, 8 starts and 10 outings. He pitches twice in relief in September. You know, he's got that ERA. It's under 5, but the FIP is closer to 6. But then in the postseason, he pitches 9 times and is good most of those outings in relief. And it's not even that if he had never come back last year, yeah, we would be having these conversations of, okay, well, the guy's just got to go in the bullpen. That's probably going to be best for him. But no, we saw him do what a lot of people think he should be doing, and it looked pretty sweet because he didn't have to kind of work through a full lineup. He could just throw the splitter as much as he wanted. We didn't have to worry about the third pitch. Obviously, fastball command is going to matter in any role, but we saw a version of him that could be really helpful for a really good team in the highest of leverage. And the Dodgers are deciding no. And I get it because of the bigger picture with him and how young he is and what you want him to get to. But right now, it is a curious decision. Let's move off Roki, but let's stay on the Dodgers because, you know, when you're putting this list together, you can make an argument that, you know, 10 of the 50 should be Dodgers. And you did end up with 4 other Dodgers on the list. Mookie Betts at 28, Yamamoto and the newest Dodger, Kyle Tucker, at 14 and 15. And then, of course, Ohtani at 1. We don't have to talk about Ohtani at 1. That is obvious.
Whoa, spoilers!
What are your... Oh, sorry. Yeah. And I'm really ruining all the... there's a baseball list. Ohtani's at 1. There you go. There's your answer, folks. But let's talk about the other 3 because I think Mookie's on his own. You kind of grouped Yamamoto and Tucker together. That editorial decision, I don't need to harp on too much. But I do think that Mookie in particular is one that I am still more compelled by. Right, like Freddie Freeman is not on this list. And Freddie Freeman is one of the most important players of the 21st century. What he's meant to the Dodgers is humongously important. But at the same time, he's not on here. So why did you pick Mookie and Tucker and Yamamoto over someone like Freeman or Edwin Diaz or Dave Roberts?
Yeah. Edwin Diaz, I thought about. Dave Roberts could be you could do a ton of Dodgers, but you're telling a similar story in a way. And that's kind of why Freddie, at least to me, is not compelling right now, because he's still pretty good. Like, yes, he's older than Mookie, but his decline is going slower. What happened to Mookie last year was so interesting. So he had the worst offensive season of his career, pretty easily, but also moved to shortstop as a 32-year-old and was a Gold Glove finalist. That's nuts. Okay? That's nuts. And then in October, he didn't turn it on. Mookie did not homer in the postseason last year. And now how related is that to him losing all that weight at the beginning of the year when he had a stomach illness, right? He lost 20 pounds. The bat speed and the strength wasn't there. If he's healthy, does the offensive prowess come back? I don't know. But remember, Mookie Betts has 7 more years on his contract. I don't want to sit here and be this Hall of Famer needs to prove that he's worth all this money, because that's not the case. But a bounce back would be a good thing for the Dodgers.
Yeah, I'm totally with you. I would have Mookie even higher on this list. I think him becoming a plus shortstop and the possibility that he could, because he is one of the greatest players of his generation and clearly someone that is committed to finding more of an offensive impact that he used to show. We've certainly seen him be an impact defender in right field. This is a guy who already has, 6 Gold Gloves in right field while being an awesome hitter. And so if he can, before last year, OPS plus by year with the Dodgers, right? 147, 126, 140, 165, 143. This dude hit 35 homers, 39 homers not that long ago, 24-19. And then last year he did hit 20 home runs, but that was more the product of being in the lineup every day than being some certified slugger. The fact that he's taken to Yamamoto's training, some of his training processes, I don't know what words you want to use.
I'm all in on this. Let me hop in on this.
Yeah, it's great.
So Sensei Yada Sensei, who is Yamamoto's training guru, Mookie sitting in the dugout and seeing Yamamoto warm up and then being a shortstop for the last out and going, whatever the hell that guy's doing, I want that, because that is working. I don't care how wonky it is. I don't care if it involves me carrying a small Japanese man on my shoulders at spring training. It doesn't matter to me. Yes, the answer is yes. So good for Mookie Betts for adopting that attitude, because look, he could rest on his laurels and cash his checks and do Twitch streams with Aiden Ross, but he has decided to continue to try and improve as a baseball player.
Yeah, and I think that's why we really should not doubt him. Yes, I think the strength that he lost because of that illness to start last season clearly impacted him, but some of the other parts of his offensive profile were still intact. The dude doesn't strike out. That's still essentially true. The walks were down last year, but it's not like he was never walking. So there's still a path to him being a good hitter again. And if you pair that with plus shortstop defense, then yes, he's going to be getting MVP votes again. He's going to be right back there at the top. And that is also part of why the Dodgers are as good as they are.
Let's do it this way. Do you think Mookie Betts gets an MVP vote this season?
Yes. Yeah.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah.
The two other guys I grouped together, Yamamoto and Tucker, because to me, they represent different things we think about the Dodgers. I think one of the questions around this team is their dominance boring? Is it good for the sport? Is it bad for the sport? Is kind of different. Is this entertaining? Are we entertained by this dominance? I'm a big cycling fan, and the best rider in the world now just wins all the time. He wins. If he starts a race, he wins it. And as amazing as he is, it's like, do I need to tune into this? Because he's just probably going to win. Kyle Tucker is kind of the epitome of that. Him joining up with the Dodgers is very Monstars. It is very Durant to the Warriors. It is, oh, they need this guy too. The contract, it being so much money for such a short amount of time, is part of that. Yamamoto, though, is the flip side of that, where even if you are the biggest Dodger hater, what he did last October and the way that he pitches, how aesthetically enjoyable it is, it's hard to hate on that, dude. It really, really is. And so that's why I put Yamamoto and Tucker together, because I think they're these really good emblems of an interesting conversation about the entertainment value of the Dodgers.
I totally agree. And the last thing I'll say about them, and then we'll move off the Dodgers. Ohtani chasing a Cy Young is kind of what we're thinking about with him, at least in the regular season. But I have to imagine it's something Yamamoto is pursuing also. And that is a really cool dynamic, that coming off the workload, we know we're not expecting they're going to let Yamamoto be throwing complete games in May and June. But this is someone that is continue to get more comfortable with each successive start stateside. And there's no reason why he can't win the Cy Young. It's just that his pal Shohei might be trying to do the same, where those two guys' innings, workloads end up will also be very interesting. Okay, I think a natural transition here from the Dodgers, it's only fair. Let's talk about the Blue Jays, who almost won the World Series last October. Their reward? Just one player on the top 50. The Toronto disrespect continues.
Disrespect.
Vlad Jr. at number 10. I think that just on the basis, if we are going to quibble with rankings, I would still have Vlad Jr. higher on this list slightly. I made the case
for... My Bryce Harper homerism knows no bounds.
I understand. Vlad is pretty self-explanatory. Vlad was at number 2 a year ago on this list, a ranking that ages so beautifully. You could not even have wished how well that would age. Now, at the time, he had still not signed his $500 million extension.
Yes. I want to hop in on Vlad. This is the one I wrote just before we started recording. Where do you think Vlad finished in AL MVP voting last year?
I would guess like 9th. But it might be lower because I know he didn't hit a lot of home runs. Okay. Yeah.
13. And that's the thing. Vlad's contract and the decision to stay with Toronto forever was very newsworthy and a very good thing. Vlad's performance in October, where he hit 8 homers in 18 games and won the ALCS MVP, was a very good thing. In between, he was merely very good. Now, maybe I'm picking nits, but Vlad is the type of player whose offensive output should not be merely very good. It should be elite. Vlad should not be finishing 13th in the MVP in a season where he plays 156 games. I think am I being too harsh?
No, that's like, I think that's a great point. I think that's a great point. Now,
he
hit
23 homers. And his OPS started with an 8, like 848. Like, Vlad, you should be hitting at least 30, and you should have an OPS starts with a 9. That's what you do. You're Vlad Jr. And I think that now with Bichette gone, the Blue Jays need him to be that version of himself that he has been twice in the past, in 2021 and again in 2024, where he was like a top 5 hitter in the world, full stop. We know it's in there. We've seen it in long stretches. We saw it in October. Vlad needs to do it over a full year this year.
And I think the case you just laid out, in some respects, could push him higher on the list, right? But I see what you're saying. I think it is a valid point. Criticism is a little bit strong. The other Blue Jay that I argued for is Dylan Cease. Just coming off the contract that he just signed, understanding that this pitching staff in some ways looks very similar, but in some ways looks very different. How bold of a bet that it was for Toronto to come out right out of the gate, fresh off the World Series loss, and say, here's $200 million to get Scott Boras to agree to a contract that fast was I think, said a lot about what they view, how they view Dylan Cease. It's a lot about how they view themselves. We know that the rest of their offseason maybe didn't go exactly as planned with the pursuit of Tucker coming up short and some of their other moves. But I think that Cease is just so important because of the commitment that they made and because of how enigmatic of a pitcher he already is. He's already kind of a controversial figure from a statistical standpoint, I would say. You know, we love Dylan Cease the person, and I'm looking forward to seeing this next chapter for him. But yeah, so I would say if I was going to put another Blue Jay on here, then Cease would certainly be a strong one. You know, Kazuma Okamoto is another interesting one. You know, of course, the Japanese guys we can maybe get to that have come over. But yeah, I just wanted to make sure we gave the Blue Jays their due. I'll let you kind of pick where we go next year. We'll hit a couple other ones. There are a couple other teams that have multiple representations. Do you want to hit on any of the non-players that you think are important on this list?
Sure. I'll just say I have Ron DeSantis, the governor of Florida, on this list. The reason for that is revolves around the Tampa Bay Rays stadium deal. The Rays have struggled to acquire the political capital necessary to get that deal done. Their new owner, Patrick Zalupski, is like buddy-buddy, thick as thieves with Mr. DeSantis. DeSantis put him on the Florida Board of Governors. Zalupski donated like $250,000 to DeSantis's failed presidential campaign. And so now that Zalupski is running the Rays, he's got this, you know, the most powerful political figure in the state kind of backing the stadium project. And I think that will give the Rays the political grease necessary to get this deal over the finish line. They kind of came to an agreement on acquiring some state land from Florida in February. They're going to try and build it next to where the Yankee Spring Training Complex is. But I think, frankly, like DeSantis, who played college baseball at Yale with Mike Elias, is going to try and put his face on this project as much as possible. And I think will be a pretty visible character as we move forward in terms of this discussion.
Yeah. And that's a good example of just right place, right time in the course of history to impact the structure of Major League Baseball. I would say there are some other interesting figures, some front office figures on the list, like Paul DePodesta, what the Rockies look like finally turning over their front office. I think at the ownership level, having John Seidler, the San Diego Padres, on here, we know that they're in the process of selling the Padres. And who ends up buying the Padres, when you think about how much baseball has changed because of what Peter Seidler did? Like, the Padres going from irrelevant to as relevant as any team we have just because the owner decided that was going to be so. It just reminds you of how much power these individuals have and what their priorities are and what their passions are. It can completely alter the direction of a franchise and a fan base and a city and a roster and the careers of Manny Machado and Tatis and Jack Samero and all these things. And so what happens with the Padres ownership situation is certainly very interesting. And then, you know, you zoom even farther out. Of course, we have Rob Manfred and Bruce Meyer near the top of the list, with the expiration of the CBA coming up at the end of the season. That is maybe a less fun topic, but certainly one that will dominate the discourse, whether we like it or not, throughout the regular season as actual negotiations begin, which will begin. I mean, this is the why will it actually matter in the regular season? Do we expect them to come to a deal before the end of this? No, but they are going to start meeting, and we are going to start hearing from both sides what their goals are and their priorities are. That is going to happen well in advance of December 1st when the CBA expires, and how that slowly leaks out, how Bruce Meyer chooses to communicate now that he's in charge because Tony Clark made some poor decisions, how Rob Manfred chooses to communicate on behalf of the owners, including some owners that are now changing over. All of that is very compelling. And will certainly give us some podcast fodder throughout the season.
So this is what I wrote. I'll just read it. Because with the collective bargaining agreement set to expire December 1st, the whole baseball world is preparing for a messy, acrimonious battle. A league-initiated lockout is happening. Owners want a salary cap. The union does not. Missing games is a real possibility. Whoop-de-freaking-do. That's how I feel. Like, it's like we're going to get some stuff because they're going to start bargaining. They're going to start having conversations, both Meyer and Manfred will say things in public that the other thinks is inflammatory, and then we'll talk about it on the final segment of a podcast because we'd rather talk about the baseball. last character I think that's worth bringing up that is not a player that I have on here is one Mr. C.B. Buckner. Who is C.B. Buckner, Jordan? And why did he make my list?
So C.B. Buckner is a longtime umpire. I believe C.B. has been in the big leagues since the start of the century. Yeah, I mean, he's pushing almost 30 years now as a major league umpire. And with the introduction of the ABS challenge system, umpires are now going to be their own characters. We have already had the introduction of tracking umpire effectiveness in terms of ball strike recognition with sites like Ump Scorecards, which I am a huge fan of. That has already been in the space since we've had pitch tracking technology. And we can say, all right, there were this many pitches in the zone, and this is the number of calls that these umpires got right and wrong. And so I've gotten very familiar with which umps are really good at this and which umps are really bad at this. And it should come as no surprise that C.B. Buckner, who has had many an incident on field in terms of ejections and just some really bad calls, has not been a very good home plate umpire. However, I love that umpires are characters. Some people hate it. I think it's great. And I think that while the discussion around ABS and robot umps has said, well, this is removing the umpire from the equation. No, no, no. This middle ground is actually making them more compelling because now they will be judged in another respect. How many times will C.B. Buckner have a ball strike call overturned? That happened already in spring training. There were games where people were like, well, it's C.B. back there. He's probably wrong. Let's just challenge left and right. Sometimes that will work. Sometimes teams will probably burn through their challenges early in the game because they just assume C.B. is wrong. And then maybe you'll have the opposite situations where you have, you know, a Jeremy Rahak back there or a Will Little or guys that are kind of locked in. And you're like, uh-oh, like this guy was probably right. I'm scared to challenge here because this guy's got like a 96% success rate. So we could have put a bunch of different umps on here. But Buckner in particular is one that interaction, that interpersonal dynamic, that is not robots. This is something that we're going to see play out in real time with this new technology. I'm so excited to see how it happens.
Jordan, when an umpire has a pitch challenged and turns to the crowd to let them know, what do they do as part of that physical process? They take off their mask. And this, to me, is a fascinating part of what we're going to see. You and I are sickos, and we know what umpires look like. The umpire behind the dish will occasionally take off their mask to have a conversation. This is going to be different because in the moment where we are judging and grading these people, they will be laid bare. We can see them now.
Exposed.
Right?
Yes.
And they are physically exposed. So like mask off. Okay. And so I think that will push umpires into like a more known, they will become more recognizable and more famous and bigger characters. And I agree with you. Like, I think that that's interesting. We will know more about these people. We will know what they look like, what they sound like. Right. And I can't wait to see how it all plays out.
And I've referenced this, I think, on the pod before. I saw this in action in the fall league when I went in November. And there was one particular umpire that was so locked in that he was getting so many right, because in the Fall League, I think, and maybe it was the Fall Stars game, they just gave them unlimited challenges just because they were testing out the system and whatnot. And this guy got so many correct that you would hear fans, when he would like nail one on the corner, be like, literally, genuinely, nice call, Blue. It was like, damn, well done. Okay, you were on that, you know? Like that. I don't know how often that's going to happen in the big leagues versus the very strange collection of Fall League spectators. But all of this, in both directions, this is going to be very, very, very interesting. All right, let's hit a couple more before we take a break.
Yeah.
Listen, Ohtani is number one. I think last year you had Vladimir Guerrero Jr. at number two. Again, this is before he has signed his extension. We're thinking about his future with the Blue Jays or without the Blue Jays. Where are the Blue Jays going? Where is Vlad going? Is he going to get traded? Is he going to be a free agent? How much is he going to get paid? Is he going to sign an extension? Some of those conversations, topics, themes apply to number two on this year's list, Tarek Skubal. Some of them are similar. Some of them are different. I think at the very least, the notion of an extension is certainly infinitely less likely than it was with Vlad Jr., who I think all along the way I always thought they are going to work this out, even as they went into the season without it. They did make it through spring training without an extension. They did get it done early in April. Skubal is not in that, but all the other things about if he gets traded, how good can he be going for a third straight Cy Young? How much is he going to get paid in the offseason? Can he stay healthy? All of the, and then now coming off of WBC, Skubal is something, coming off the arbitration win, right? Skubal is something we are talking about no matter what. And so I think he definitely belongs at number two here.
The lack of an extension getting done makes it more likely he gets traded, though, in a way where Vlad was harder to envision. I think that the way the Tigers operate somewhat more ruthlessly and calculating than the Blue Jays front office, you could envision a scenario where Detroit is out of it in the middle of the season and Skubal goes on the market and like, holy crap, would that be a big deal? I have Joe Ryan on this list at 48 because I think he is going to be the best player traded at the deadline. And it is very rare for number one starters, top of the line guys, to get dealt at the deadline. It hasn't really happened since 2021 with Max Scherzer going to the Dodgers when he was still elite. Okay. Before that, it was like Verlander in 17, John Lester in 14, Cliff Lee in 2011. Skubal would be, if dealt, the best pitcher dealt at the deadline. Maybe ever. Maybe since Randy Johnson would be like the line, you know, in 1999, I believe. But yeah, Skubal is a big, big deal. Let's go one rung below him to number three, where Aaron Judge sits. And I'm kind of getting tired of talking about this, but I do think we need to bring it up just once. Aaron Judge is the greatest Yankee of all time that does not have a World Series ring. That is a fact. It is an unfortunate fact. It is the inverse of a backhanded compliment. It is a kind insult in a way. This is baseball. Judge cannot single-handedly change that. He needs help. Last year, because of what he did in October, that ball he hit off the pole, even though it didn't really matter for that Yankees team, mattered so much for Judge's playoff legacy and reputation. And now it's like, does he get the support? It has gone from like, oh, LeBron can't get the job done to LeBron needs help, right? And I think that is a very interesting shift in how we talk about Aaron Judge.
Yeah, and whether it's fair or not, his last few games in the WBC didn't particularly help the discourse for the lazy folks that think he's a bad player when the games matter. But hey, it's all perception. And the longer you go without winning as a Yankee, this is kind of what you get. So he is amazing, and he is one of the best right-handed hitters of all time. How long he can keep that up will be very interesting. And with the Yankee team that looks remarkably similar, whether that's a good or a bad thing will certainly be debated all season long. But his quest for that championship at last does begin tonight on Netflix against the San Francisco Giants, who I will just mention here quickly before we take a break. Also have a couple of individuals on this list, including Rafael Devers and their new manager, Tony Vitello, who you can read about. I wrote about Tony Vitello this week. You can read that today leading up to opening night on Netflix. So, yeah, I mean, the Giants are compelling. The Yankees are compelling. There's a lot of teams that are compelling, and that's why you should read Jake's top 50 most influential individuals in baseball. Before we take a break, remind everyone that fantasy baseball season, it's not almost here. It is here, folks. But even if you can't draft before opening night, there's still time. And we encourage you to draft with your friends or join a public league on Yahoo Fantasy. Sign up Yahoo Fantasy app or at yahoofantasy.com/baseball like we did, because we both hosted a league. Plot twist, Jake couldn't help himself. How about this?
I had FOMO. Okay. I wanted to do it too. Jordan organized the league, went through all the emails, got it all set up, did his draft. And then yesterday afternoon, I was like, what about me though? So I organized my own league with all the people that emailed. I emailed everyone that responded. I picked 15 other people. We're drafting today at 12:30 while I'm on the train headed up to New York, getting it in just under the wire. People are going to be drafted from work. Okay.
Love that.
Three catchers, because I love chaos. Oh, that's how I roll.
Nice.
Three catchers. And Jordan, we're going to kick your league's ass. I don't know how that will manifest, but my league is going to take your league to the cleaners, dude.
That's great. We'll see how that. Yeah, exactly. I don't know what that means, but I do appreciate that. And yeah, I'm glad you mentioned drafting at work, because drafting on your phone on the Yahoo Fantasy app, super easy. So you don't even have to pull it up on all your different monitors at work. This is as easy as it gets. So we encourage
unless
you to
I
go
lose
sign
service
up there.
As the Amtrak goes through rural Delaware, I'm going to be good.
You're in good shape. All right. We will keep you updated on our respective leagues throughout the season. All right, we're going to take a break. When we return, it's time for the opening day starter draft. We'll be right back.
And welcome back to Baseball Barbacast. Opening night is tonight. Opening day is tomorrow, which means it's time for one of our favorite traditions here on Baseball Barbacast, the opening day starter draft. The rules are simple. There are 30 pitchers starting on opening day. Jordan and I will draft them. Whichever person's staff of 15 has a lower ERA after all their opening day starts wins. Jordan, you are the resident historian. Do some history, please.
This is the third year we have conducted this exercise, at least in this form. And in year one in 2024, it was not close. My starters were so much better than Jake's. It was frankly embarrassing. And I kind of can't believe he even agreed to do it again in 2025. That year, my starters combined for a 3.7 ERA. 3.76, while Jake's had over a 5. Now, that was your effort that season was. But I will point out that your effort that season was torpedoed by your last pick, Kyle Freeland, who allowed 10 runs in 2 1/3 innings.
Oh.
Now, I will point out that even if you get rid of those 10 runs, I still would have won. So it's not like it was the only reason, but it made your total look pretty bad. Now, I bring that up because last season, Kyle Freeland became very relevant again. Once again, he was one of the final two picks. However, Kyle Freeland went 6 scoreless against the Rays, and that proved to be the difference for Team Jake, who ended up with a 3.40 ERA, just barely besting my opening day starters with a 3.47. That was also compelling because last year the Rockies and Rays did not play until Friday. This year, we have multiple teams opening their seasons on Friday, so that kind of complicates things. We will still draft those starters, and we will update the scores when we get to Friday. But Kyle Freeland has been the difference, essentially, in both directions the last 2 years, both times with Team Jake. And most compellingly, Kyle Freeland is back on the board in 2026, getting the opening day nod for the Colorado Rockies once again for the fifth time. And because this year he is facing the Miami Marlins, I am not sure that he is going to go last, especially with this narrative heft that he comes with. However, enough about Kyle Freeland. You understand the exercise. 30 starters will be taking the ball. Hopefully these are the 30 that actually take the ball. Last year, Tanner Bibee got like food poisoning and I ended up having Ben Lively start for me instead. He was actually pretty good, so that wasn't that big of a deal. But hopefully all of these guys remain healthy from now until them taking the mound. And with all that preamble out of the way, let's get to it. I'm going to have the first pick this year because
you go first because you were a loser.
And you had
you were a loser last year.
Yeah, because I was a loser. However, I do not see a super obvious number one pick. And the fun of this draft is that there are a lot of really good pitchers. So some of them are facing good teams, some of them are facing bad teams.
Okay.
But
you don't
I'm
see
just
a super obvious number one pick? I do.
But I'll do
I see it.
Okay. Okay. I am curious to see who that's going to be. But with my first pick, I am going to take Hunter Brown against the Angels. I'll just go Hunter Brown against the Angels. I went with a lot of players against I went with a lot of matchups last time, and it mostly worked out for me. Jake is saying, what's wrong with you? And that's fine. I think I know where you're going with your first pick.
Yeah, I'm going to take Tarek Skubal against the Padres. Yep. Tarek Skubal has won two Cy Youngs in a row. San Diego is one of the friendlier pitching environments in the sport. It's and the Padres lineup is way worse than you think. So I'm not going to overthink it. And I'm going to take Tarek Skubal. Thank you so much for that. I appreciate it.
That is it. That is, I had that thought.
Is that defensible?
Tarek Skubal.
Is that a defensible pick?
Absolutely. Tarek Skubal was an interesting one last year, of course, coming off his first Cy Young. You ended up taking him third against, that was against the Dodgers, a little bit different, more challenging. He did allow four earned runs, which was the third, which was the second highest total of any of your pitchers. So we'll see. I think that San Diego, this is also a nod to the San Diego environment, which I do think is just going to be, no matter what's going on with the Padres, I just love watching Gabe Zepeco. So we'll see.
Sure.
We'll see. I believe Tarek Skubal did allow a run to.
In Great Britain? You're worried about Nate
Great
Eaton?
Britain.
Okay.
I am worried about Nate Eaton. I'm worried about Fernando Tatis.
You go ahead.
Is what I'm worried about.
You go ahead.
All right. With my second selection, I am going to go ahead and take Chris Sale. I'll take Chris Sale against the Kansas City Royals. Chris Sale is really good, and he is shockingly healthy. So I think him is someone, he's someone that I feel good about. His seventh opening day start, which I believe is the most of any pitcher starting on opening day this year. So I will take Chris Sale against the Royals.
Now, Jordan, you told me before we did this podcast that you did not prep for this, that you are shooting from the hip, that you're winging it. That is a bit of a character shift. Typically, I am the one who does the winging of it, and you do the preparation. And I think that this is going to prove helpful for me as I take Logan Gilbert of the Seattle Mariners at home against the garbage Cleveland Guardians lineup. I get my top two guys on the on my board. So there you go.
Gilbert was definitely going to be next for me. He delivered for me last year. And shame on me for waiting to take him. Now I'm going to swerve back towards your strategy of just taking the best pitchers. And I'm going to take Crochet here. Now, he's pitching in Cincinnati, which is not awesome. But Garrett Crochet is so good. And the Reds lineup, I'm not super sold on. So I think Crochet is one. I'll just be like, look, he's one of the best pitchers in the world. Is it stupid to leave Paul Skeens on the board this long? Probably. He is facing the Mets. You will be there. But let's see where you go next.
I'm going to take Paul Skeens.
Okay. Yeah.
He's Paul Skeens.
Yeah. He is Paul Skeens. Yep. Paul Skeens, good pitcher.
Yeah. Thanks.
Now, last year, he was the first overall pick. He went 5 1/3 with 2 earned runs against the Marlins, which, as the number one pick, was a disappointing showing, I would say.
Sure.
So we will see how he does against the Mets and Queens. You will be there to watch it. And you know what? I'm gonna stay right there, and I'm gonna take Freddy Peralta against the Pirates.
Good pick.
I think Freddy Peralta is really good. I think the Pirates' offense is improved, but I don't think it's good. So I will go ahead and take Freddy Peralta there.
I will go with Christopher Sanchez. Recently signed an extension with the Philadelphia Phillies. He will be throwing at home against the Texas Rangers, who are fine to not great at hitting. Sanchez, remember, unanimous Cy Young runner-up last year, which was unprecedented in its own right. He is one of the best five pitchers in the world. I'll ride with that.
Good thinking. Okay. So not as many obvious matchup picks here at this point, but I'm just going to go ahead and take Yamamoto. Probably a little early against the Diamondbacks because the Diamondbacks can hit, but I do think that the bottom of the lineup is still maybe not awesome, and I think Yamamoto is awesome. So I want Yamamoto on my team, so I will take him here.
I'm going to take Max Fried. I think this is the best matchup remaining on the board. Pitching in San Francisco is very helpful, and it's hard to envision him peeing his pants. So I'll go with the Yankees lefty.
I will also lean in on the matchups here and take Sandy. I'm going to take Sandy Alcantara, sixth opening day start against the Colorado Rockies. This is at home, and I think that will help. I think Sandy is going to have a better season, and I think pitching against the Rockies is probably going to go pretty well.
Alrighty. I am going to go with Drew Rasmussen of the Tampa Bay Rays, one of the most underrated arms in the entire sport. He will be facing off against the St. Louis Cardinals in St. Louis. It's a good matchup. He's a good pitcher. Happy to get him this late in the draft.
I will also take one of the last pretty damn good matchups here, and I'll take Mizorowski. Give me the Miz against the White Sox. I'm a little bit worried about length here, I think.
Opening day Miz, dude.
Opening day Miz is going to be something. This could super backfire. I could see him going out there and being way too amped up and just throwing a bunch of balls. But I'll take him here. I'll go along for the ride.
Are the Phillies mad that Christopher Sanchez isn't starting on opening day for the Brewers? Or are they okay with Miz doing it?
That's a good question. Someone should ask John Middleton.
I will take Nick Pivetta of the San Diego Padres, who's going up against the Detroit Tigers at home. Kevin McGonigal is very good. I still don't love Detroit's offense and think Pivetta is a good matchup for them. I do think Kerry Carpenter will hit two solo home runs against Pivetta, but he'll be good otherwise.
Give me Trevor Rogers against the Twins. Trevor Rogers with his one ERA last season against the Twins lineup that I don't particularly love. But hey, maybe Trevor Rogers is just this good. And him getting the opening day nod is pretty impressive. So I'll go with the guy with the one ERA or whatever it was. Sure, we'll do that.
Wow, hot take. I'll take the nicest person in baseball, Matthew Boyd of the Chicago Cubs, who will be going up against the Washington Nationals lineup at home in Chicago. I'm going to Google Chicago weather, and I'm going to see that on Thursday it will be in the mid to low 50s with some drizzle. That is not exactly a good hitting environment. I assume the wind will be blowing in from the lake, and Matt Boyd will throw a complete game shutout.
Okay. I think I will take, So now there's a couple really, really good pitchers still on the board, and the matchups aren't awesome, but I don't know how much longer I really want to let them slip. So because of that, I think I'm going to go with Logan Webb actually against the Yankees.
Okay.
It's at home. I feel better about that. And he's not coming out of the game anytime soon. You know, even if he allows a couple of runs, he's still going to go 5 or 6 or 7 innings. And so that's going to kind of prevent against maybe some more treacherous ERA inflating totals. So I feel solid getting Logan Webb in his guaranteed innings at this point in the draft.
I'm going to take the best pitcher on the board, in my opinion. That's Cole Reagans of the Kansas City Royals. Yeah. Will be going up against the Atlanta Braves. Don't love that matchup. Also super fun that he is going against Sale. If you want to watch some lefties absolutely huck it, that's for you. But yeah, give me Reagans.
Okay.
Six spots left for each of us.
Yes, for each. Okay, I'm going to go here. I'm going to go matchup here because then it's just going to start getting a little bit more difficult. I'll take Libertor. I'll take Matthew Libertor. Little bit of a revenge game. Opening day, Matt Libertor against the Tampa Bay Rays. A lineup that is very strange and new and weird and different. So, yeah, I'm kind of in on Libertor being solid this season, and I'll take that matchup there. Because the rest of these matchups I'm not loving. So where are you going?
Last year, I think someone said that Jake's strategy for this was best pitcher available, go brr. And I'm just going to stick with best pitcher available, go brr. And I'm going to take Joe Ryan against the Baltimore Orioles.
Ooh. See, that's interesting because I thought you were going to go in a couple other directions when you said best pitcher available. So because of that, I think I am going to go with... Yeah, I'll go Kevin Gausman. I know this A's lineup could mash, but I'm going to take Kevin Gausman. I'm realizing I have essentially only taken pitchers that are pitching at home. That was not on purpose. But every single pick that I've made is a pitcher at home except for Crochet in Cincinnati. We will see if that continues through the remainder of this draft. I'm running out of pitchers at home. But I guess there's only one pitcher left that's pitching at home. So I don't know. I just think that the energy in Toronto will be awesome. Gausman's another one, kind of like Webb. Even if he allows a couple homers, like he's going to go five or six. And so it feels like a safe pick. I think the A's lineup is going to be good, but I'll take Gausman here.
The time has come. The time has come. We live in a free land, at least. Oh, at least in theory.
Oh,
Kyle
boy.
Freeland, welcome Ooh. Back. I will go down with the ship. He will be starting in Miami against the Marlins. This is probably far too early to be drafting Kyle Freeland to do anything, but I'd rather be too early than too late.
I will take Tanner Bibee in Seattle. Bit of a mulligan for him. As I mentioned, I believe it was food poisoning the night before his opening day start last year in Kansas City. In Seattle, good pitchers
shrimps.
Park. Is Cal Raleigh gonna hit a really far home run? Maybe. But I think Tanner Bibee's pretty good. Another guy I expect to give them innings and in a good pitcher's park and someone on the road. So look at me. So brave.
Nate Eovaldi against the Philadelphia Phillies. Yep. Come on down. Eovaldi was incredible last year. Like a unbelievable pitcher. He had what? A 1.73 ERA against 22 starts. Thanks. I'll take him with my fourth to last pick.
He was the one I was between when you were talking about best pitcher available, thinking about Joe Ryan, thinking about Gausman, thinking about Eovaldi. So I think that's a good one. So just to reset the board here, there are six pitchers
left.
Six. Who's remaining?
Shane Smith remaining? Against the Brewers. Cade Cavalli against the Cubs. Andrew Abbott against the Red Sox, who I think you're going to take. Jose Soriano against the Astros, Zach Gallen against the Dodgers, and Luis Severino against the Blue Jays.
Abbott is I think, yeah, I'll take Abbott here. I'll round out my all-home team staff. A little risky. Again, it's not that the Red Sox don't have a good lineup, but most of their best hitters are left-handed. All of their best hitters are they're all left-handed. So in that respect, I think the matchup is pretty good. I am a little worried that Wilson Contreras will hit a three-run home run, but if he can avoid that, Andrew Abbott is a pretty damn good pitcher. And because of the specific kind of lineup that he is facing, I think that this is actually pretty good value here.
The only thing more important to me than being right is making you laugh. That is the entirety of this operation, Jordan. It is why we do what we do, why we began doing what we've been doing now for 13 years. I'll take Jose Soriano against the Astros.
I mean, I love Jose Soriano. And yeah, I mean, how good is the Astros lineup? I don't think we really know.
That's the thing. One of my staple takes for this season is going to be the Astros are going to stink. And I'm going to hop right on board out the gate with that one.
All right. This is going to be maybe a bold pick, but the last 2 years, I have benefited from Chicago White Sox opening day starters. In 2024, I got Garrett Crochet. Remember, at the time, it was like, oh my God, they're Garrett Crochet starting opening day. This is ridiculous. He's barely been a starter. He gave me 6 innings of one run ball against the Detroit Tigers. Last year, I went to Sean Burke, who gave me 6 scoreless against the Angels, which was part of why I was so excited to take Hunter Brown this year. And so this year, I will take Shane Smith, the former Rule 5 pick. In Milwaukee, don't love the ballpark, and the Brewers find ways to score runs, of course. But I'm not that scared of that lineup, and I love the Shane Smith story. So give me Shane Smith.
I was in Cade Cavalli's press conference the other day at Nats Park when he was talking about his opening day start.
Which is all you need to – that's enough for him to not be – which is disappointing because I think – I was probably going to take him with my last pick. Instead, I'm choosing between Luis Severino in Toronto and Zach Gallen at the Dodgers. And while I do think Zach Gallen is going to be better this year, I'm taking Severino. I'm taking Severino after watching him absolutely dominate against Team USA.
That was awesome.
I think he can do it against Team Canada. On opening day at Rogers Center. Luis Severino, welcome to the squad. Jake Mintz, you will take Zach Gallen at the Dodgers, which gives me, again, of my 15 selections, 11 of them will be pitching at home, which means Jake has the opposite. We will see how this unintentional strategy works out. I do think you look quite good early on in this draft. I feel like I rallied. I feel pretty good with my selections. But this thing is a total crapshoot, and we have no idea what we're talking about. To recap, Team Jordan will be sending out there to pitch on opening day. Hunter Brown against the Angels, Chris Sale against the Royals, Garrett Crochet against the Reds, Freddie Peralta against the Pirates, Yamamoto against the D-backs, Sandy Alcantara against the Rockies, The Miz against the White Sox, Trevor Rogers against the Twins, Logan Webb against the Yankees, Matthew Liberatore against the Rays, Kevin Gausman against the A's, Tanner Bibee against the Mariners, Andrew Abbott against the Boston Red Sox, Shane Smith against the Brewers of Milwaukee, and Luis Severino, Dominican ace, against the Toronto Blue Jays. Team Jake, what
you
got?
I have everyone else, and my guys are going to kick Jordan's butt. Scooble, I don't even need to save the teams. I'm not even going to save the opponents because it doesn't matter who we face, my guys. Like, we don't
that good.
Even think about it that way. We go out there and we pitch, baby. I'm going to go, you know what? And to show that I believe in everyone on my team, I'm going to go from the bottom up. Okay? I'm going to go from the bottom up. Zach Gallen, Cade Cavalli, Jose Soriano, Nady Evaldi, Kyle Freeland, The Ledge, Joe Ryan, Cole Reagans, Matthew Boyd, Nick Pavetta, Drew Rasmussen, Max Fried, Christopher Sanchez, Paul Skeens, Logan Gilbert, and Tarek Skubal. Championship.
We will update you on Friday, assuming it is still close,
wait.
At least.
Oh, Jordan, real baseball excited. Games. Oh,
and
wow.
Just to remind,
I'm feeling zippy.
Just to remind folks, those 3 games on Friday will be Blue Jays A's, Rockies Marlins, and Braves Royals. So some pretty important pitchers there. We will see how the ERA scoreboard looks when we awake on Friday morning. We're going to take a break. When we return, a quick around the league before we say goodbye.
And welcome back to the end of Baseball Barbacast. It's been too long. Let's go around the league. When does spring begin? March 20th. That is also the start of extension season.
It's true. This is a popular time for players and teams to collaborate on long-term pacts that keep them in place, keep them as franchise anchors for the long haul, buy out some free agent years, and say, I believe in you. And that is what happened with the Chicago Cubs, and Pete Crow Armstrong, who agreed to a 6-year, $115 million extension beginning in 2027. This is a deal that will buy out 2 free agent years, but still allow PCA to reach free agency, I believe, at age 31. At roughly $19 million a year, I don't know what the exact breakdown is, if it's backloaded or frontloaded or whatever, but we're looking at a roughly $19 million AAV. Again, buying out 2 free agent years. Even with the lopsided production that he gave last season, that is better than a $19 million player. However, as we always say with these young player extensions, where it's easy to be like, what is he thinking? He's leaving all this money on the table. You can understand that when, you know, $100 million guaranteed is put in front of you, and it's a deal that doesn't prevent you from reaching free agency at a ridiculous age, I think it makes sense. PCA loves being in Chicago, and I think he's earned this kind of deal, demonstrating both the floor and ceiling that he can provide. He still has a lot to work on. He still has to prove that he can. I mean, there's a lot he has to prove with the bat after what happened in the second half last year. But when you are essentially the best combination of base running and defense in the sport right now, or at least in the very, very, very short list of that group, it's an obvious player to invest in and kind of build your position player group around.
Someone that did not get an extension over the last couple of days is Connor Griffin of the Pittsburgh Pirates. And that is part of the reason why he will be beginning this season in AAA. Now look, Connor Griffin, top prospect in the whole sport. You probably saw a lot of cool highlights of him hitting home runs during spring training. Well, you want to hear the sad truth? That was kind of all he did. Griffin was just okay in camp. He did not blow the cover off the ball. He did not force the Pirates to put him on the roster with his play on the field. And for that reason, I think it is relatively defensible that Pittsburgh is going to start him in AAA. He has never played in AAA. He is 19 years old. There are still some holes to his game. It is, in my opinion, doing the player a disservice when you push them too quickly. Are there some service time manipulations going on here? Maybe. But as far as egregious service time gobbledygook goes, this one doesn't raise the alarm system for me as much as some others have in the past.
I agree with that. And the argument against it is looking at what they are going to be rolling out in the infield with Nick Gonzalez and Jared Triolo and whatnot. But I agree with you. I mean, he turns 20 in a month. He only played 21 games in AA last season. So to have him play a month or two in AAA, like, I think this is a different conversation than the one we were having about Paul Skeens when he was so obviously one of their best pitchers, even with limited minor league, you know, experience. In this case, I think it's a reasonable developmental decision.
And do the Pirates deserve the benefit of the doubt here? Probably not. However, I do think the dynamic at play with their GM Ben Cherington is relevant, where he is kind of on the hot seat. And I think that if Ben Cherington thought that having Connor Griffin on the opening day roster was going to win the Pirates the most games this season, I think he would have done it. I do.
Yeah.
And so I expect to see Griffin at some point this season, but our pitchforks and torches are not aloft at this news.
However, you mentioned that Griffin did not, you know, bang the door down and make it clear that I have to be on this team. That is essentially what happened with the other best prospect in baseball, Kevin McGonigal of the Detroit Tigers, who the Tigers announced will indeed be on the opening day roster, which is kind of amazing. And maybe I should have viewed this as more of a possibility going into the spring, and I'll explain why in a second. But just to set the stage here a little bit, he also has not played in AAA. He also only played 46 games in AA last season. Now, he's a little bit older because he was drafted the year earlier, so he is already 21. And he was also in the Fall League, which is, you know, considered prospect finishing school. It's a little bit less that than it used to be, but he was the MVP of the league. He had a 1200 OPS, which even adjusting for the bad pitching in that league, he looked like the best player there. And then in spring training, he looked like one of their best players, one of their best hitters. And most importantly, he looked like a pretty good shortstop defensively. And that development, whether it sticks or not long term, honestly kind of reminds me a little bit of what happened with Julio Rodriguez when he was showing up trying to make the team. And for years, it was like, okay, well, he's clearly going to be a right fielder. He's enormous. He's not that fast. And Julio essentially decided, I am elite. I am special. So I am going to decide that now I am a plus center fielder. I don't know if Kevin McGonigal is going to become a plus shortstop, because that is, I think, even harder than becoming a plus center fielder. At the same time that he showed the team that he could be a viable shortstop, on top of how advanced of a hitter he is, which is one of the most advanced hit tools that we have seen in the minor leagues in a long time. That is why you have quotes from AJ Hinch saying, getting back to what you just said about Ben Cherington, AJ Hinch saying, we're trying to win a World Series. This guy can help us do that right now. And every game is going to matter for a team like this, for an offense like this that desperately needs something new, something different, something better. And I love that they were willing to do this. And I have one more thing to really drive that point home that I'll share. But what are your thoughts on McGonigal?
I was talking to an American League pro scout at spring training about McGonigal, and I said, "Do you think that Kevin McGonigal can play shortstop?" And this person looked at me and said, "Kevin McGonigal can do whatever he wants." Mm-hmm. And that's kind of how I feel about Kevin McGonigal now. Like, he is so talented that he is going to will himself into being competent at this very difficult thing. His in-box athleticism is so special. It is the very rare combination of short to the baseball with legit rotational juice and elite swing decisions. You often get two. A lot of guys have one, very few have three.
And I should also point out about him, is he going to play shortstop right away? They still have Javier Baez, you know, now Trey Sweeney's kind of out of the picture. And at third base, they have a bunch of different options. I mean, that's what, if the Tigers have anything, they do have flexibility in terms of defensive versatility and whatnot. So where exactly he fits in defensively doesn't matter. The point is he certainly hit his way into the opening day lineup. That part is not surprising. And what I think about is a conversation that I had with Scott Harris last year. And I just remember talking to their GM, Scott Harris, like in September last year. And this is when stuff was not going awesome for the Tigers. And, you know, Scott recognized that. But I just remember just having some vague conversations about just what they had coming and just the conviction that they had in this next wave with McGonigal as the obvious headliner was so strong. And I think in that sense, this should not have surprised me, because this is the strategy. They spent zero on upgrading any of their offense because they looked at what they had in this prospect and said, this guy alone can change the complexion of our offense. Now, that's probably too much to put on him this quickly. At the same time, when you're this good, I don't want to rule it out that he can, the way that he impacts, the way that he's driving pitchers crazy, driving up pitch counts, putting balls in play, showing power, showing speed, you know, all these things, maybe it can lengthen the lineup. Maybe it can just make it that much harder to pitch to. It's a big bet, though, because, yeah, they decided to focus on kind of augmenting the pitching staff with their resources and running it back with an offense that was just really, really bad for the second half and into October. So it does display the trust and the confidence that they have. And because of that, because of how I should have seen that once Kevin McGonigal showed that they weren't going to wait around. If he's already one of their best hitters and they believe they can finally win the division. Remember, sure, the Tigers have pushed themselves into relevance the last couple of years. They have not won the division since 2014. So that's one of the longest division droughts that we have in baseball. And so we will see if this is the year they can finally kind of get over the hump there and win the AL Central. Kevin McGonigal will, of course, be a big part of that. He is not the only top prospect that made the team. We saw Carson Benj make the team with the Mets. You'll see him on opening day. We saw J.J. Weatherholt. That one has been essentially guaranteed since last season ended. You know we love J.J. He's someone we've had a lot of fun talking to over the years, and excited to see him with St. Louis. Of course, not going to get the kind of shine on the Cardinals as maybe some of these other guys on teams that are going to be competing, but we definitely believe in JJ Weatherholt. All right, Jake, one more thing before we say goodbye. How am I going to watch this game tonight starting the season?
Yes. Netflix and thrill. Oh. That's the plan for tonight. All right, so here's the deal.
Netflix and Tim Hill.
Dude, that's so good. Can you tweet that? Netflix and Hill, and it's just a picture of like you and Tim Hill on the couch.
I hope he pitches. I hope he comes in to face Devers tonight.
Oh, Netflix and Hill. Anyway, yeah, this will be on Netflix, I guess. MLB is making it, they say, easier to watch baseball by putting it in so many places. I say more confusing because I don't know how I'm going to watch this. This broadcast is going to be unlike any baseball broadcast we have ever seen. I think it is going to be so awful that it is going to be unbelievable. I cannot freaking wait for it. Here's the lineup of human beings involved in this production. Okay. The desk, like the pregame desk, is going to be Albert Pujols, Anthony Rizzo, L. Duncan, and I think Barry Bonds to some extent.
Pretty sure Barry Bonds is involved in the pregame stuff as well.
There will also be contributions from comedian Bert Kreischer, NFL quarterback Jameis Winston, WWE tag team champs Jay and Jimmy Uso, and a special appearance from The Thing from a TV show on Netflix called Wednesday, which appears to be a dismembered hand. The booth itself will be Lauren Shahadi, very good at her job, very like normal baseball reporter. She will be on the sideline. The booth will be CeCe Sabathia and Hunter Pence with Matt Vasgersian on the call. I don't know how this is going to go. It's going to be so chaotic. We'll see how long I can stick it out. But again, if you're listening to this podcast, like this broadcast is probably not for you. You're already too close to the screen here. Like, you'll go listen to John Miller on the radio if you're like us. Mm. This is for a new audience. How many new people are going to watch this broadcast and be like, the dismembered hand from Wednesday? I got to tune in for more MLB this season. Who knows? But I am excited for this.
All of the weird cameos, I don't even know how to process how they're going to fit in, what they're going to contribute, whatever. I think the question is quite literally how it looks. Because in theory, if Netflix is going to be producing a baseball game, it will look different.
It's going to look interesting.
They will be attempting some cinematic effects that are, you know,
a
change of pace. And whether that's going to be good or bad, I don't know. That's what my curiosity, I think, is focused on.
Jameis Winston and or Brett Kreischer will be in kayaks in the cove.
Yeah. Well, they said that they're going to have a bunch of kayaks out there. Like, I think I read that they're going to have 73 kayaks in honor of Barry Bonds, all of his home runs, which is also really interesting. To have like
so many kayaks.
That's a lot. I think that's more than usual. But maybe there would be that many out there on opening night. But this is not Netflix's only appearance or broadcast this season. They will also have the Home Run Derby and the Field of Dreams game, dude, which is returning, which has not been back since 2021 and 2022. So who knows what any of that will look like. The Home Run Derby will, you know, we expect to be there. So I don't think we're going to get to experience that in the same way. But we will watch this tonight and we will see how it goes. Maybe they will shock the world and we will come on here on Friday and be like, why isn't every game on Netflix? That was awesome. Perhaps that will happen. But at the very least, it is one heck of a way for Tony Vitello to make his managerial debut.
Tony Vitello's like, are these all on Netflix?
No, this is not normal, Tony B. Should have put Tennessee's you know, midweeks again on Netflix. Those were have always been quite entertaining. Thank you all for listening to this final off-season edition of Baseball Barbiecast. It's back. The regular season is here. Now we can talk about games that matter. Goodbye, spring training. I will not miss you. I did not watch you at all. Thank you for listening. Thank you to Andrew Hartz and Ingrid Roses for producing. Thank you, Jake Mintz, for co-hosting with me and participating in yet another opening day starter draft, which I am so confident I will maybe possibly win, probably not, that I look forward to gloating on Friday morning. Until then, you can email us at baseballbarbiecast@gmail.com. We'll talk to you all soon.